Welcome to the 33rd episode of the Frank Online Marketing Show, brought to you by IBM Canada. My name is Tema Frank, and I'm your host. What better way is there to celebrate Canada Day than with an interview with the CEO of Canada's largest e-commerce retailer, Staples? Staples got into the e-commerce world way before most companies in Canada. They've been at it for 16 years now, and they've had consistent double-digit growth for many years. In this interview, Steve talks quite openly about some of the things that have helped them achieve those levels of growth and how they continue to make sure that their website is constantly improving and finding better ways to meet customer needs. We also have a wide-ranging discussion that covers things like the challenges of measuring the return on investment and whether or not you should seed comments in your social media to try and get conversation going. So I'm sure you will enjoy this interview, and I look forward to chatting with you after. You've been at it for quite a while. When did you first open an online store in Canada?
We've had a non-transactional presence since 1995, and then we opened the transactional site in 97. So it's been going on 16 years now.
So you got in it quite early. Were you involved at that point, or?
Yes, I've been involved with the company since inception in 1991.
Do you remember what the discussion was? I mean, what motivated people there to take it seriously when so many other Canadian retailers weren't yet?
Well, I think our belief was that this was going to be happening, and a number of us on the management team held a strong belief that having first mover advantage, regardless of the geography or regardless of the format you're in, has always been a big advantage for retailers, whether here or in the U.S. or anywhere else in the world. So we thought this was an opportunity for us to be first in consumers' minds and business minds that we were there, and that's why we established the informational site. And then also, once we got the back end done, we were the first in terms of the space that we were in on the transactional side. So we thought that was important to be there, even though we expected that our sales for the first little while would be modest.
So how long roughly did it take for it to become successful, to become a profitable part of your operation?
It took a couple of years, actually, before it became profitable. Keep in mind we had a huge upfront investment in terms of development and the back end and so on and so forth. So that's really the most expensive part, and the feel and the look. So it took a couple of years before it got to a break-even point, not before it was profitable in the sense that you've also covered your carry-forward losses. So mm-hmm. You know what, I honestly don't recall how long it took before it was profitable in the truest sense of the word.
And the thing is, setting it up then was so much more complex. Everything had to be hand-programmed because you were quite early in the market.
That's true.
So other than the first mover advantage, what else do you attribute that success to?
A healthy dose of good luck, I think.
In what way?
In that it would have been very easy for many of our major competitors to jump on board at the same time. I think they felt that it was so far off in the future that they might as well wait until they see how things shake out before they start competing online with us. So, in other words, what would be the standardized formats, whether it would be HTML or some other format, and so on and so forth. So that's what I mean by being very lucky, in that our competitors decided that they would adopt a wait-and-see approach.
Yeah, okay.
I think the other thing that's made us successful is we, as a company in general, tend to be extremely customer-centric, and I know there isn't a CEO in the country that doesn't say that. But if you actually take a look at what we've done, it's really, I think, resonating with lots of people, which, by the way, you may or may not be aware of the fact that we are the number one e-commerce retailer in Canada.
Yes.
So.
Well, and I've got to admit, I've been buying online from Staples for a very long time.
Thank you. We appreciate the business. So what we do, as you probably know, is that when you log back on, we say, you know, well, welcome back, Tema. You know, we can go to your favorite aisles, or you can go to what you purchased the last time. Try and make the experience as easy as possible. We have a number of usability groups that we use, and we're in constant contact with them on a monthly basis as to what we can do to improve the experience and have an iterative process of improvement so that we're constantly looking at how can we make the next version of our platform even better than the last. And I think the customers appreciate the fact that we're always looking for ways to be better. I think that also differentiates us from our competitors as well, in that sometimes the expression, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, seems to stick in an awful lot of different people's minds. In our philosophy, it's there's always a better way of doing things. Let's find that way before somebody else does.
It's so great to hear you talking about usability because it amazes me. I mean, I've worked in usability since 2001, and it always amazes me how many companies don't seem to see the value in that. They don't want to pay for it. They figure somehow their website designer knows everything, and they can't.
Exactly. The other thing that I think has made us so successful is our network of bricks and mortar stores across the country has proven to be extremely positive. Canadians in general, unlike their U.S. counterparts and British counterparts for that matter, tend to be much more cautious in terms of transacting online, and have strong bricks and mortar presence that's really national helps eliminate or at least mitigate a lot of the risk and uncertainty of doing business with a company online. They know us, they know our brand. If you buy something online, you're not happy with it, you have a choice. You can return it online, you can come into one of our stores and exchange it there or get a refund there. So they know that they're going to have a very happy shopping experience with us regardless of how they transact with us. And the fact that we have that physical presence there gives them that confidence to shop with us. And then the other option that we have that I think is something that's very positive is our delivery options. And I'm going to say close to 90% of the country, we have next-day free delivery on orders over $50. Back then, that was unheard of. Today, it's getting more and more to be the entry price of getting online is providing free next-day delivery.
Absolutely. Certainly, that was one of the things that I've always loved about it. Do you find, and you talked about the ability of people to return things to the store, giving them a confidence level, I would think that would also, in some ways, lower your costs of dealing with returns, or does it?
It doesn't, because believe it or not, I would say at least 50% of what's returned to stores are not items that we typically carry in stores. They're rather esoteric items. Yes, they're esoteric items that people will buy from us online because our assortment online is, I'm going to say, about quadruple what it is in stores. And by the way, we're growing that as we speak. We hope to have about 200,000 SKUs online by the end of this year, and we currently have, I'm going to say, just under 8,000 SKUs in store.
That's huge.
It is.
So how are you managing that transition? How do you make that big a leap?
With great difficulty. We're learning along the way. We're skinning our shins and picking ourselves up and dusting ourselves off. But I've always felt that if you're going to make mistakes, make lots of them, make them quickly and get it over with, and, you know, move on to the next thing. So we're learning the hard way, but it's been extremely gratifying when we're seeing the kind of uptake that we get, especially from small business customers that are now looking at us as really a consolidator of everything that they need to run a small business.
So let's talk about some of those mistakes. What have been some of the challenges or the painful learning that you've done over the years of experimenting with your Canadian web presence?
Well, first and foremost is managing that expectation for next day delivery, especially in remote markets. And, you know, frankly, also managing the expectation for customers when there's a torrential downpour. You know, customers in Calgary, just a great example. I was expecting the order before 5 o'clock today. Okay, I'm sure you were, ma'am, but you understand that the city's in, you know, lockdown mode and we're not going to be able to get it for you today. And it's surprising how people expect us to leak tall buildings in a single bound of what the realities are of the weather, whether it's a snowstorm or you know, rain or flooding or what have you. It's critical for us to not be judgmental and, you know, to listen to our customers' concerns and always remember the lifetime value of the customer, which helps us, you know, ensure that customer's always right.
Yeah. I wonder if there'd be any way to automate, whether it's a call or an email, to customers in a situation like that where you know there are likely to be problems in a particular city, just to warn them.
There might be, but I can honestly tell you, we've done that in the past. It's been moderately well accepted at best.
Really?
The expectation is really that, I thought you guys were experts at getting these products to us.
Right.
It's interesting how customers really expect, when they're giving you their money, that they want to be able to get the service on their terms.
Mm-hmm.
One of them, the second one I would say is really the cost of investment given the slow adoption of Canadian consumers to online shopping.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to make a significant investment up front, and depending on how crowded your space is, the return is going to come, you know, somewhere along the line and perhaps not in the timeline that you first envisioned it. So I think having the patience to understand that these things take time, doing whatever you can to accelerate that in a cost-effective way, certainly something that we've learned the hard way. And then the third thing is, you know, again, having to do with the slower adoption of online shopping in Canada is also the fact that it's much more difficult to find and recruit specialist talent with the e-commerce experience because that gene pool, so to speak, is so limited.
Interesting. Do you see that, I mean, Canadians have been a little slow to pick up, although partially they've been slow to adopt online shopping because they haven't had a lot of Canadian options. Have you noticed a significant increase in your numbers of customers who are purchasing online in the last couple of years, or is it you were already far enough ahead that there wasn't?
For us, it's been, you know, fairly good. It's double-digit growth. It's been consistently that way for many years, but I think part of the reason is of our market niche as well. We have both small businesses, which is really our target audience, as well as consumers in general. So we're pretty comfortable in that respect.
Some of the issues, I mean, obviously the investments, something that a bigger company can probably afford a little bit better. But are there any of the lessons from your experience that you think would also apply to smaller, mid-sized businesses?
Well, I think the one thing that I've noticed consistently is small and mid-sized businesses don't necessarily think about their value proposition, or another way of saying that is what's a value and what's not a value to their customers.
Yeah.
So, you know, they think that, you know, this is my site, you know, I've got great product, I'm going to, you know, put it up on the web a certain way, and sometimes they overpay for things that is really a little value to their customers, and sometimes they underplay things that customers will consider to be of great value. So an example I can give you is it's surprising how many small business websites, I can't say about mid-size, but small ones that I've been on, where after you buy something, the next time you go to buy it, you have to fill out the information all over again as if you're a new customer.
Yeah.
From my perspective, I can tell you it would be of great value to have a profile online. I may not want to leave my credit card with them, but all the other information would be there, so all I would have to do is input my form of payment.
Yeah.
So there's something as an example that would be of value to most customers.
Absolutely. Well, and also I think, I mean, again, I don't know how expensive this gets to do, but one of the things that is nice about Staples is that not only do you remember our basic data, but you also remember what we've bought and can sort of make suggestions based on that, which also helps save time. But I know that gets a little more sophisticated to do that.
Yes, you're right. That's a whole different level of sophistication, which I would imagine most small businesses and probably most mid-sized businesses would not be at that stage at this point.
We met each other at the retail conference, and certainly everyone was talking about e-commerce becoming more important, but do you get the sense that Canadian retailers are really starting to get serious about e-commerce, or is it just lip service at this point?
Well, certainly I think there's a huge lag between ourselves and the U.S. I think part of it is, you know, some of the data that I've seen lately, I'm sure, is also in the late press as well, in that Americans shop online at a rate of about 8 times that of Canadians. So I think Canadian companies are thinking that they, again, have lots of time left to catch up. So I think that's part of it. I think the risk of spending a lot of money online and not really understanding your return. Clearly, when you run an ad, whether it's a newspaper ad or a radio ad, you have a pretty good track record of what that's going to produce in terms of item price. And I think most businesses understand that return on investment. Clearly, they're less sanguine about investing in something as unknown as the web. I think the complexity of it scares a lot of people, even when they hire an outside contractor. I've got a great example of one of my very good friends who just retired 2 years ago and decided to set up his own small consulting business. He said he called in a fellow to help him design the web, his web page, and he said, after about 10 minutes, my eyes glazed over. I had no idea what he was saying. He was speaking English, or at least I think he was, but I didn't understand any of the words that they meant. So the complexity, I think, would scare a lot of small business people as well. And I think the last piece is not really understanding the cost structure. And by that, I mean, I don't believe that there's an online retailer in the country, I probably will also include the U.S., an online retailer in North America that makes money on its first transaction with a customer. You really make money after a customer transacts with you a number of times, and I don't know what that number is on average, but I can tell you we don't make money on a first-time customer because of the cost of acquiring that customer and setting up the order and fulfilling and so on and so forth. So I think part of the fear is also not understanding the cost structure from what it's going to cost to acquire that customer, to service that customer, and then to actually be able to get that customer back. So I think all those uncertainties, you know, play large in terms of how small businesses view this space as being one where, yes, you can make a fortune, but you can also lose a lot of money.
Well, and it's interesting because I see this a lot with, and I know I've even made this mistake myself in running my own businesses, is there is this tendency to constantly be looking for new clients. And yeah, you do need to keep that happening, but it's a lot more expensive in any business to get a first-time client than to get repeat business from them. And I think you make an excellent point that a lot of businesses get so focused on getting them in there that they forget to give the kind of service that will encourage them to come back.
Exactly.
That is interesting. But it's interesting to know that even at your level, that's still a bit of an issue. The other complaint, and you mentioned also delivery challenges of expectations of consumers. I mean, one of the things that I hear over and over again is, well, it's just the country's too big, so postage or delivery costs are too high. Given the vast size of this country, do you think it's even realistic for smaller companies to try to compete online?
Well, I think it is because I think the options for e-commerce solutions and distribution and logistics are becoming a lot more cost-effective with more and more people entering the mix. So, you know, in the past, that may not have been the case, but it's funny. I was in our Vernon, B.C. store last year, and the perlator truck stopped at our store because we're one of the hubs there, and literally picked up everything in the store and filled their truck. They couldn't make any other stops that day. So a lot of that were people that were transacting on eBay and shipping out packages throughout the country. So I was asking our manager, like, was this a particular busy day that we have a special on, you know, a prolator promotion? And she said, no, really, this happens, you know, quite often. And it's 90% of it is eBay shipments out of the city to other parts of the country.
So you're saying that people are selling, they're buying products from you to resell on eBay at a markup?
No, there are customers who have product to sell, and they bring the package into our copy centers where we also have a prolator station.
Oh, okay.
Right, and then pay for delivery from there.
Okay, I get you.
So the whole idea is as these perlator trucks become more filled with product, the cost effectiveness obviously increases. It's a lot more cost effective for everybody involved for perlator to leave with a full truck than a less than full truck.
Absolutely. The other question I'd like to ask you about, because of course it is such a hot button topic these days, it revolves around social media. And I'm wondering how involved your company is in social media and what your thoughts are on the usefulness or not of it.
So we've been very involved with it. I think we take every opportunity we can, again, because we are so customer-centric, to interact with our customers and engage them in finding out what it is that they're interested in, what they like, what they dislike. I think these days for people not to be involved in social media is a big mistake, because whether you like it or not, people are talking about you. So either you can be involved in the conversation or you can play the ostrich, but that doesn't necessarily mean that people aren't talking about you. So we're very cognizant of that. For us, it provides great insight into what our customers feel about our products and about our services and the entire customer experience. Another benefit for us is really a way to discover our customers' preferences. It's kind of, hearing somebody say, I was at Staples the other day and I didn't see any green widgets. What's with that? So it gives us an opportunity to then go back to our and say, you know, we've had 16 comments about green widgets this week. Maybe it's the hot thing. We should look at that. So it's really a nice, inexpensive way to do market research. And I think, you know, a lot of people don't realize, by carefully listening to that and doing some analytics, the amount of information they can get on that.
Mm-hmm.
On the flip side, there's certainly challenges. I can certainly tell you, I recall the day, and here I am aging myself, that when someone was PO'd with your company, they'd pick up the phone and yell at somebody and, expect issues solved, you know, within a day or so, and then that morphed into sending emails and expecting the issue was going to get resolved, you know, again within a day or so. Today, when people when they say something on Facebook, their expectation is that this is going to get resolved within the hour.
Yeah.
So I think that's a real challenge for us, and we've had to implement dedicated resources because we really saw the value in it for us.
So you have dedicated people monitoring, presumably. What have you had to change, though, about internal processes for dealing with these types of complaints?
What we had to do is have a single point of contact in terms of decision-making on these things. So in the past, when somebody called a customer service center, if it was something that was out of their realm of control, they'd say, well, I'll have to get back to you. They would call the product manager. The product manager may or may not be in a position to make a decision. He or she may have to call the manufacturer to find out what we can do about it, and the whole process would take 2 days. Now we've got single point of contact people who make the decision then and there, and then, you know what, we'll figure it out on the backside of it. So we have a dedicated customer service team that responds to this, because the customer doesn't really care what happens in the background, whether you get credit from the manufacturer or whether you don't, you know.
Yeah.
Their problem is their problem. You know, your problem isn't their problem.
Right. You must have to do some pretty careful training then of those people, because you're giving them a lot of decision-making authority.
We do, but instead of giving them, you know, here's the rule book for the 111 rules, we give them the sandbox in which to play. And we say, for the most part, use good judgment and don't worry about making mistakes, because it's a statistical certainty that you will. You know what? Just do the right thing for the customer. Afterwards, let's review what's transpired. And then when we do that, we'll be in a good position to go back and say, okay, the next time this happens, how would you handle this differently? So we do have some guidelines on social, but for the most part, it's more of a here's what the size of the sandbox looks like.
That's great. That makes a lot of sense. And I would think that would also make for happier customer service staff, because being able to resolve the customer's complaint right away must be much more satisfying than saying, oh, I got to get back to you, and then go through a whole rigmarole inside.
Exactly. Exactly. And our turnover rate in the customer service team here is probably one of the lowest in the industry, because people truly feel empowered to make customers happy and also feel empowered that after they've thought it through, if the answer is no, that unless an egregious mistake has been made, they're not going to get overruled by their supervisor.
Right. In terms of the social media, you've talked about benefits in terms of understanding your customers better. Any other particular benefits that you see from your participation in social media?
I think the other thing that it's done is we've also tracked longitudinally since 1994, I'm going to say, what we call apostles or net promoters. Net promoters is out of every 100 people that like you, subtract the number of people that publicly claim not to like you, and what do you end up with? So what it's helped us do is it's helped us really create a whole new cadre of net promoters that would gladly refer us to their friends, because we track that.
Right.
We know how well that number has grown. So as I said before, the more you can improve engagement, the more you can improve loyalty, the more likely that you're going to end up, you know, making more money, because those customers will return. They in turn will tell their friends, and the really interesting part about the way social media is growing is the new king of social media is your friend or someone that you met online, not an advertisement that you see on TV or something you read in a magazine that's put forward by the company. So there's a lot more credibility to those people that say, you know, I love Staples, I've been shopping for 10 years, here's all the great things that, you know, they're doing for us. It's like a real connection, as opposed to somebody selling me something and a little bit of cynicism seeping in saying, now, I wonder who those people really are and, you know, why they're saying this. I think there's a different behavior when it comes to hearing suggestions online, and that people feel that they've got a real connection with those people that are similar to me, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other downside of this whole thing is, at the end of the day, you know, for many companies, engaging social media is kind of like a dial tone on the phone. When you pick up the phone, you expect there to be a dial tone, and you never get any positive feedback if there is, much like you would never... Bell or Rogers to say, hey, I got dial tone again for the 6 day in a row. Congratulations. But when you don't get dial tone, that's when you can expect that people are going to get pretty agitated. So I think a lot of companies are kind of seeing that from their perspective, there's no upside, only downside to this. And I guess really it all depends on the filter they put on it. Right? Because as I said at the outset here, you can pretend people aren't talking about you, but the truth of the matter is they are, and you can either be engaged with them or you can pretend that, you know, it doesn't exist.
What are some of the things that you've done to encourage people to talk about you in a positive way on social media?
Actually, to be honest with you, we've avoided doing that. I've had that idea myself a while ago, and everything works fine, providing everybody that you've encouraged to help you do this remains your friend or your employee, so to speak. But the minute you know, people are disgruntled for whatever reason, they'll tell other people that you know, this whole thing was fabricated, and then you lose your credibility. So we would much rather be in a position where people of their own accord decide to, you know, speak up, positive or negative, hopefully a lot more positive, and then you know, just increases your credibility. And then you never have to worry about somebody leaving your company and saying, oh, yeah, we got 200,000 great comments because we seeded the comments.
Excellent point. And certainly my experience has been, I mean, if you're running a good company, and I think you are, then you will have people naturally want to defend you when somebody attacks.
Yes.
I've had that experience as well. So certainly that's the better approach.
We do run contests and you know, we're part of Air Miles. We have Air Miles rewards as well to encourage people to speak up. But that's encouraging them to speak up either positively or negatively, not to say only positive about us. So we want a lot of dialogue. We just don't want to be the ones that are curating that dialogue.
Okay, that makes sense. So have you made any attempts to measure the return on investment of your social media efforts?
Hundreds of efforts.
Any successful ones?
We've never really been able to do an effective job because there's so many moving pieces and so many things that are out of your control that it's really not something that we're able to do. And frankly, any of the numbers that I've seen where people have attempted to do that, you can poke holes in them in under 5 minutes because, as I said, it's very complex and a lot of variables. At the end of the day, you know, you've got to believe that you're either going to engage with your customers or you're not. That's really what the key is.
There were so many interesting things that Steve said in this conversation. It's kind of hard to narrow it down to just a few. But if I were to do that, there are a few things that I think are particularly valuable in what he said. One is that you need to be patient. It takes time to build the customer following and to actually start making money on your e-commerce ventures. You simply cannot expect that the very first transaction you have with any given customer will make a profit. Often, where you need to look for your profit is developing such a good site and such a good reputation that people come and do repeated transactions with you. The related issue to that, of course, is that when you are making changes to your website or planning your first website, you always, always, always have to think from the customer's point of view. That it's far too easy to say, ooh, there are these neat little whiz-bang tools and we really should have these because it would be cool. Well, it may be cool, but it may also cost you a fortune and provide something that the customer doesn't especially need and very few of them particularly want. You'd be much better off spending your time and effort figuring out what core services and capabilities do your customers really value, and then making sure you deliver those at a super high level. And the final thing that I think is worth stressing is the importance, as we've heard over and over again, of having excellent customer service staff and communications with your customers. As Steve put it at one point in the interview, the customer doesn't care what happens in the background. They want to be able to speak to one person and have their problems solved. So that requires that you train your customer service staff in a particular way and that you give them the freedom to make decisions, knowing that you'll back them on whatever those decisions are. Basically, they told the staff, use good judgment and don't worry about making mistakes because it's a statistical certainty that you will. Take these thoughts to heart and you'll be well on your way to developing a profitable long-term web presence. That's all for today. Please send me your feedback, your comments, your thoughts, your questions. I'd really like to make sure that these podcasts are delivering the sort of experience to you that you would like to have. You can always reach me by email, Tema, T-E-M-A, at frankonlinemarketing.com, or visit our website, also frankonlinemarketing.com. And on the website, there's a button there you can click to leave a voicemail message. If you leave your URL, you can also get a little free online plug for that. And you can always pick up the phone and call us toll free at 1-866-544-9262. Thanks again to IBM Canada for their continued support of this show. And I will chat with you next week. Bye.